Okay, this is lecture number five. Lecture number five in philosophy, our introduction to philosophy. And we've covered the first five chapters, and now we're on chapter six. And I want you to take a look at chapter six. You start a whole new section there, and the section is called What is Knowledge? So whenever we're dealing with philosophy and knowledge, you're dealing with epistemology. Philosophy of how a man knows. Okay, so keep that in mind. In fact, you might want to note in your table of contents that part two deals with epistemology, knowledge. Part three deals with what is reality. So part three is metaphysics. And part two, what is knowledge? That's epistemology. What is reality? Metaphysics, part three. Part four, what is the ultimate? What is the ultimate? Because the ultimate is worthy of worship. That's philosophy of religion. And part five, what is good or right? That is ethics. You will go a long way to understanding, getting a better grasp of this book, if you keep that in mind, that each of those sections is talking about the four main branches of philosophy, so that no matter what you're getting into, because I tell you, you can get into dualism. What does dualism mean? Well, are you talking about epistemological dualism or metaphysical dualism? So it can get incredibly complicated if you don't recognize that the same word, dualism, will mean different things if you're talking epistemologically than if you're talking metaphysically. Metaphysically would mean that there's two realities out there. It could be dualism, could be mind and spirit. Then again, you could be talking about dualism in as far as two gods. But then if you're talking epistemologically, you could be talking about the knower and reality, what he knows. And so it's real important. But keep in mind, we are on epistemology, chapter 6, and this section goes chapter 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So we have got five chapters there on epistemology. So we're going to be on epistemology at least for the next two lectures, I would think. Now, the question that he asks for this chapter is, can we know? And can we really know something? Can we know something to be true? And to answer this question, you have to deal with a topic that is called skepticism. 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 All skepticism means that you suspend judgment. Suspend judgment. Now, there's different kinds of skepticism. Some skepticism is complete skepticism where you suspend judgment on everything. Other areas are limited skepticism where you just suspend judgment on just different areas. So we're going to look at skepticism. The issue is not what we believe, but what we are justified in believing. Not what we believe, but what we are justified in believing. A good skeptic never agrees with any premise. A good skeptic will make the an argument impossible to even get started. Okay? There's not many good skeptics because there's so many premises they have to accept just to live. I mean, if a guy's a real good skeptic, if he's going to live like a good skeptic would live, he's going to starve to death real quick. Forms of skepticism. Three different types. There's thoroughgoing or complete skepticism. Thoroughgoing or complete skepticism. There's also mitigated skepticism. And then there's limited skepticism. In fact, there's actually even two more. There's methodological skepticism, and then there's irrationalism. Let's take a look at these. Thoroughgoing or complete skepticism says that we have no knowledge whatsoever. Suspend judgment on everything. There was a philosopher, Sextus Empiricus, about 150 AD to 225 AD when he lived. Now, skepticism did exist long before him, but he's probably the first key guys for us to key on. Socrates had to deal with the skeptics, so they predate Socrates. So you're going before 400 BC, so they've been around a long time. But let's just key on him. His skepticism had three stages. First, it was the antithesis. And yet, by the way, you don't have to jot this down. This is just informational purposes here. His name is important, though. But his skepticism had three stages. There was first the antithesis. Two contradictory claims were made about the same subject. Then you would suspend judgment because you didn't know which was true and which was false. And then you would reach a point that he called ataraxia, which is a state of unperturbedness, a state of happiness, peace of mind, freedom from dogmatism. So his goal was that we would reach a point of complete skepticism. We would suspend judgment about everything, and that's supposed to give us peace in life. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, obviously, you shouldn't be skeptical about the fact that you need food to stay alive. And to suspend judgment on that, you're not going to live too long. Now, David Hume is a real important guy. He is also under thoroughgoing or complete skepticism. He lived from 1711 to 1776. And he had some real interesting things to say. He taught that no generalization or basically no universal view about experience is ever rationally justified. No generalization about experience is ever rationally justified. The illustration he gave was that just because the sun rose every morning, we can't be certain that it will rise again tomorrow morning. So his view attacks knowing with certainty. We experience things one thing at a time. We can never experience everything, so we can't know everything. We can't know universals. We can't know because one man lived and died, and because a million men lived and died. That doesn't tell us that the next generation of men are going to die. We can't know that with certainty. Now, his view attacks knowing things with certainty, with absolute certainty. But we can still argue that the sun will probably rise tomorrow. Okay? We can argue that we can know that the sun will probably rise tomorrow And even with what Hume has said, he made some really good points. Even with what he has said, it is still probably true that the sun will rise tomorrow. Mitigated skepticism is a skepticism that admits some limited kinds of knowledge. Okay? You can have some kinds of knowledge, but then you got to be skeptical about other things. Now, the difference between mitigated is this has limited kinds of things we can know is mitigated. But with limited skepticism, there's only small little compartments that they're skeptical about. With mitigated skepticism, you're skeptical about a lot of stuff, but there's just a few limited areas where you can know something. Limited skepticism is the reversal. You know, limited skepticism guys like A.J. Ayer that say that you can't talk about God. God talk is meaningless, and you can't know if there's an infinite being, you can't know it. They're skeptical only about religious statements or about one or two little compartments of knowledge. But mitigated skepticism admits some limited kinds of knowledge. He lists Wilkins and Glanville. The names aren't really that important for our purposes. Both lived in the 1600s. They're both members of a British scientific organization. They both said that infallibly certain knowledge, is very important. Infallibly certain knowledge is unattainable by man. Infallibly certain knowledge is unattainable by man because his abilities may be defective or corrupted. Okay? Wilkins and Glanville. Infallibly certain knowledge unattainable by man because his abilities may be defective or corrupted. But what they said was that indubitably certain knowledge is possible, however. Indubitably certain knowledge. So in other words, their mitigated skepticism said pretty much that there's no way we can get infallibly certain knowledge. We have to suspend judgment on the attempt to know anything infallibly and with certainty. However, there are some things that we can know with indubitably certain. We can be indubitably certain of. Now, what that means is it is possible for us to know things beyond reasonable doubt. Now, the only thing that's real important about Wilkins and Glanville is that beyond reasonable doubt, you can't know with absolute certainty, but it's beyond reasonable doubt. That is the basis for the Anglo-American theory of legal evidence. Okay? So it's based on a view of skepticism that says we can't know things with absolute certainty. What if you had to prove it was absolutely certain that the suspect murdered the victim? Well, supposing you had 100 witnesses. Well, it's always logically possible that those 100 witnesses were deceived by an alien who made himself look exactly like the suspect and then murdered the victim and then went back to his planet and they thought that they had seen this guy. It's always logically possible that this guy has a twin that he didn't know about. He was separated from at birth. And the guy came back into the area, when the guy was asleep, took the guy's clothes and put on his twin brother's clothes and went out and murdered the guy. Now, what's the chance? Those things are well beyond reasonable doubt. Even if you just had one witness there in that situation, it'd still be beyond reasonable doubt that that occurred. So, you find the guy guilty and sentence him to death or sentence him to life in prison, whatever it would be. Also, another type of mitigated skepticism. Actually, I guess the better way to describe mitigated skepticism is it's being skeptical about having absolutely certain knowledge in any area, but you can have less than certain knowledge, a knowledge beyond reasonable doubt or some other type of thing, so you wouldn't have to be left with total skepticism, but you should still be a little bit skeptical about all things. But you can know things beyond reasonable doubt with Wilkins and Glanville. Now, Immanuel Kant, who also falls in this category, he's very important to philosophy. He's also in the area. Immanuel Kant. Okay. He taught that all knowledge begins with experience, but that three sciences, he taught, are not possible. And you don't have to jot all this stuff down by him. It's in the book, but even there, you won't see it on the test, but I'll explain to you what you need to know about him in a minute. But he said three sciences that are not possible: science of a supposed real world, we can never be sure about every aspect of the real world; science of a supposed real self; and a science of God based on pure reason. He argued that the cosmological argument for God's existence, the argument from effect of the effect of the universe to God's existence, that fails because the principle of causality may not apply to God. And he thought that God is not an object of sense experience, so we really can't know it. So he embraced a metaphysical skepticism. We can't know reality as it is. Okay? And so he taught that the knower does not conform to the object known. I don't conform to this pulpit, okay? But the pulpit conforms to the knower. And what the key is, and this is all I ever ask about Kant, or at least in an introductory course, is he believed that we could know reality as it appears to us. But we cannot know reality as it is. Okay? We can know reality. I can know this desk as it appears to me. I can know my views about the desk. I just can't really know what the desk is in and of itself.
So he didn't dispute the existence of a true reality, just that we're not able to perceive it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And he also he argued that you could not prove God's existence by pure reason, but he argued that through practical reason we must posit God's existence to make sense out of our moral experience. In other words, we can't make any sense out of our moral experience unless you posit the existence of God and life after death. Other than that, it just wouldn't make sense. So remember that about Kant. We can know reality only as it appears to us. We cannot know reality as it is. And obviously, Gordon Clark said that view just ends up collapsing into total skepticism about the real world. What's the big deal about knowing reality as it appears to us if we have no way to know? See, and I'll tell you, but it's very, very easy to get a position like that because, okay, for me to know this wooden table, my mind is immaterial, the table is material. So I can't put this material table in my mind. I can't even shove that material table into my brain. So if I really get that table in my mind, how do I get it there? Well, can't. Yeah, but the thing is, the table really gets there. You know, we can't. Modern science can't even prove that table is hard.
All that modern science, in fact, if modern science has proven anything, it's proven it's not solid. But all we can do is prove that it feels hard to us. And that's what they're doing with virtual reality, too. You can't tell the difference between virtual reality and real reality at times the way it is now. But it, the way we know this table, or we assume this table is hard by the effects it causes on our hands when our hands touch it. We know, we assume this table is brown by the effects from that table has on our eyes, okay? But how do we know the table really is like that and all? Now, we can't get it physically in there, so some people say, well, maybe our mind takes a picture of the table. But the problem is, the only way you know if you have an actual picture is if you hold it up to the original. But the thing is, when you take a picture, your thought of the table, and you compare it with the table, it's not the table you're comparing it with. It's still another picture of the table. So you have no way of knowing they're accurate. You know how Plato got around it? Plato said the real table is not the plurality of tables, but the essence of the table, the idea of the table. And Plato argued that our invisible mind can have the real table, the idea table, the concept table in our mind. We share with God, you know, Augustine would argue, we share with God these eternal ideas. We share in the mind of God. We think God's thoughts after Him by doing that. But whatever the case, you know, that's what I was telling these guys. They had so much confidence in modern science that we're trying to refute God's existence. Modern science has to assume a whole lot of philosophical presuppositions that have never been proven before it can even get started. So to act like evolution has definitely been proven is crazy. Nobody has, to this day, nobody has ever really proven that movement is possible. We have to assume movement is possible. I kind of agree with Aquinas and Aristotle that rather than say movement is an illusion, just because we can't prove it, which is what Zeno said, I like what Aristotle and Aquinas did. They basically said, let's just accept movement as a given. Let's accept the basic reliability of sense experience, and then work from there, because that makes more sense to me. But it hasn't been proven. It's never been proven.
Yeah. So this is a form of limited skepticism?
No, this is still mitigated.
Okay.
Limited is where these titles are kind of arbitrary, really, to be honest with you. Here's the way he describes them. Mitigated skepticism on page 87 is characterized by the rejection of knowledge claims that go beyond immediate experience. However, it does admit some limited kinds of knowledge. Then limited skepticism, particular types of knowledge claims are questioned. So limited says skeptical about certain claims, like religious claims maybe, something like that. But mitigated, though, would say, according to him, anything that goes, they would reject any knowledge claim to go beyond immediate experience. We just, all we've got is the thing there. I don't know how he ties that in with Glanville, because they both, well, Wilkins and Glanville. But whatever the case, even that distinction between mitigated and limited, I don't see a big enough difference to where I don't think I'm going to really bring it up. Now, there is a big difference between methodological and irrationalism. They've got enough to be in their own, but I think these two, mitigated and limited, for the purposes of a test, I think we can group them together. The thing that they both have in common is that they are very skeptical, but not about everything. There is something you can know. You can know reality as it appears to you. You can know the transcendent realm. You can know concepts such as equality and color and things like that. But once you try to apply them to the real world,
good luck. We couldn't know reality as it is.
So the question that one of the, let's say that I look at your shirt and it's blue to me, and Roy looks at that shirt, and he says it's blue also, but is my perception of blue the same as his perception of blue? That would come under mitigated, that we can't really know. That's blue to me because I think it's blue, but that,
yeah.
I don't know what it really is.
Yeah.
I don't know how it looks.
Well, once you get to limited, the mitigated here, which anything, any knowledge claim you're bringing up about the real world, mitigated would argue, well, look, all you really, you can know what it appears to be to you, but you can't know with absolute certainty the way it really is.
So I couldn't say that shirt is blue. I would have to say that shirt looks blue.
Well,
I think that shirt is blue.
You could say, you know, in common language, you could say it, but they if you really restrict in your common language, you say, like if you were Glanville and the other guy, you would still be in the mitigated class, but you would say that shirt is probably blue. It's beyond all reasonable doubt it's blue. But to say that we're totally certain it's blue, well, there's no way of proving that.
Yeah.
Now, AJA or a company with the limited, with some of the limited skeptics, they'll give you the blue shirt. What they won't give you is the existence of an invisible God. In other words, AJA will say, well, religious talk or talk about God is meaningless. We have to be skeptical about metaphysical reality, about God's existence and things like that. Okay. There are people that argue that way, and there's some good arguments for that. Some very good arguments for that. Both Bertrand Russell and Gordon Clark argue very effectively that that the blueness in there, that's just the certain effect that the light has on our eyes. Yeah. And so I don't know. So it's really, but believe me, modern science, there's a lot more faith in modern science than people are willing to admit. So let's talk about limited skepticism. They say that particular types of knowledge should be questioned and we should be skeptical about. A.J. Ayer lived from 1910 to 1970. A.J. Ayer, very important guy. Just remember A.J. Ayer, you'll see him probably on a matching with the verification principle. Who's not to be confused with Anthony Flew, who we're also going to talk about it as a limited skeptic. Anthony Flew. He has the falsification principle.
Oh.
two different sides to the same coin, okay? You can't verify it through the five senses, says Ayer, then you can't know it. Now, logical positivism is a school of thought that A.J. Ayer had, and it has the verification principle, which says two things. One thing, it says that there's only two ways to know something. The first is it has to be true by definition, such as a bachelor is an unmarried male. That's true by definition. But it doesn't tell us anything about reality. It doesn't tell us if there are any bachelors. So, yeah, you can learn something if it's true by definition, but it tells you nothing about reality. Everything else that you need to that you can learn, the only way to know it about reality, you would have to be able to verify it by sense experience. So truths about reality, not just definitionally true things. And I can invent the word boom and say that boom means a rug. And if I define it as a rug, it's true by definition, but it doesn't tell us if a boom really does exist. But to really know something about reality has to be verified by sense experience, by the five senses. So basically what A.J. Ayer is saying, an oversimplified definition of the verification principle is that truth can only be found through the five senses. Problem is, with the verification principle, it fails its own test. Number one, it's not true by definition. And number two, you cannot prove that it is true by the five senses. So the statement, truth can only be found through the five senses, cannot be proven through the five senses.
Did he ever have to answer that question?
Yeah. What he did, he watered down his view a little bit, but it still it was the same thing. He just didn't hold it as dogmatic. He also, before he died, by the way, did I say 1970? I think they've got the wrong day of his death. Yeah, they've got the wrong day of his death.
Yeah, 1910 to 1970, the book says.
Yeah, I think they got the wrong day of his death. This guy lived then straight on into the late 80s. I'll check on that, but I'm pretty sure they got the... He wasn't even dead when his book was written. I'm pretty sure he wasn't, because I think he's had an out-of-body experience not too long ago, before he died. Saw a red light that somehow he knew was responsible for governing the whole universe, and his whole life flashed before his eyes like he was being judged. And they asked him, well, do you believe God exists? He says, no. He says, I believe it was a real experience because I've been told by other people who had near-death experiences that had the same thing, but he still rejects belief in God's existence. Whatever the case, that's Ayer. Anthony Flew, a leading British philosopher, debated one of my professors, Gary Habermas. He holds the falsification principle. The falsification principle. And the falsification principle, he illustrates it by, I believe John Wisdom had the parable first, but he took it and used it to illustrate his own view here. He has the parable of the invisible gardener. The parable of the invisible gardener. Two guys go into the wilderness, they find some beautiful plants and stuff. One says, well, there must be a gardener, and the other one says, no, we just got here randomly. And so they set up camp, and after a few days, they find no gardener. So then the guy, the believer, says, well, he must be invisible then. And so they decide, okay, well, the only way to test him, the only way to falsify that claim, we'll have to get bloodhounds. And so they get bloodhounds, and 2 days go by, and the bloodhounds don't alert. But the plants keep growing real nice. So the non-believer says, see, there's no gardener. The other guy says, no, wait, there is a gardener, but not only is he invisible, but you can't smell him. So they set up fences and try to electrocute him. And nothing happens, and the plants just keep growing. So the believer says, look, he does exist, he's just invisible, and there's no way to falsify his existence. And then the non-believer, or Anthony Flew's response would be, if there's no way to falsify his existence, how is the invisible gardener any different from no gardener at all? And so obviously when that applies to God's existence, it sounds pretty strong. Terry L. Meathy, when he debated, two of my professors debated Flew. But when Meathy debated, well, that's the thing he brought up, he accused the falsification principle of being almost synonymous with the verification principle. Because look at all the things, all the ways that Flew wanted to falsify the invisible garden. Every one of them has something to do with the senses. So he's acting like if the gardener could not be detected by the senses, therefore it must be non-existent. So by definition, he's ruling out neither one of these guys, by the way, is saying that proves God doesn't exist. What they're saying is, even if God does exist, since there's no way to falsify the claim that God exists and there's no way to verify it, we'll never really know. Okay, so, again, with the falsification principle, it's his belief, any belief which is non-falsifiable is nonsense. Theology, study of God, is nonsense. The reputation of this is the God of the Bible has spoken. There are predictions made in the scriptures that if they were false, they could have been falsified. They were falsifiable, but they were not falsified. They came true. The miracles and resurrection of Christ. See, the Bible, the invisible gardener became a man. So there's lots of ways to fall. If Jesus said his body had rotted in the corpse, you could have falsified Christianity. Which, by the way, when he debated Gary Habermas, one of my professors, Anthony Flew got blown away, and they were debating the resurrection of Christ from the dead. So Anthony Flew had his chance to falsify Christianity. He did not do real good. The judges from all different worldviews, 7 judges voted against him, 2 called it a draw, and 1 voted for Flew. So that could be falsified. Anthony Flew's view can be falsified. Just a little play on words there. Methodological or Cartesian skepticism. Why do we call methodological skepticism Cartesian? Because it was the skepticism of René Descartes. Don't ask me why they called people who follow time, Thomas Aquinas, they call him Thomas after his first name. I don't know why. And if you follow René Descartes, they call you Cartesians. And then if you follow Augustine, you're Augustinians. But Cartesian, with a C, methodological. René Descartes lived from 1596 to 1650. And he used skepticism as a method whereby all doubt could be overcome. He wanted to know things with absolute certainty. And he figured the only way he could know things with absolute certainty was to doubt everything that could possibly be doubted until he could find something that he couldn't doubt. And then if he knew something with absolutely no doubt at all, he would know it for certain, and then he would use that as his first premise, and then start to, from that, deduce, from that certain premise, deduce all the other truths about reality that he possibly could. This was the start of modern philosophy, by the way, that man could find out everything through his reason. But skepticism was the method whereby all doubt could be overcome. Descartes began to doubt everything in an attempt to find something absolutely certain that he could not doubt. From that point, he hoped to derive all knowledge. The more that he doubted, he started doubting everything. The more that he doubted, the more he recognized the exister of himself, the doubter. That's where he said, "Cogito ergo sum." Cogito ergo sum. That means, I think, therefore, I am. And that became his point of certainty through which he tried reason out everything else. So he ended up being the exact opposite of a skeptic, but he used skepticism as a method. That's why it's methodological skepticism. He wanted to suspend all judgment on everything until he found something he could not suspend judgment on. And so the more he doubted, the more he recognized the existence of the doubter, so he said, "Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am." Irrationalism, the fifth type of skepticism, but again, we're going to group mitigated and limited together. But irrationalism is the view of some existentialists. Albert Camus is one. Albert Camus, he's thought like Albert Camus, but it's Albert Camus, which is pronounced a French existentialist. He accepted Kierkegaardian skepticism against any rational attempts to explain the world. He accepted Kierkegaardian skepticism against any rationalistic attempts to explain the world. Yet, and this is where he differs from a lot of other existentialists like Jean-Paul Sartre, he also rejected Kierkegaard's leap of faith to find meaning. See, Kierkegaard said, through reason we can't find true meaning. We need to take a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm. Well, that's what Jean-Paul Sartre is doing. No objective meaning to life. Can't find out through reason. Let's take the leap of blind faith and create meaning for our life. Well, Camus, who was a friend of Sartre, he not only accepted the skepticism against any rational attempt to explain the world, but he also rejected Kierkegaard's leap of faith to find meaning. And sure, he agrees with Friedrich Nietzsche, there is no meaning, there is no objective knowledge or values, the world is completely absurd, it's not even worth taking a leap of blind faith. So some existentialists don't even get to the leap, and they just no objective meaning, leave it there. Gordon Clark would say, well, then just, why not just commit suicide? And there's really no reason.
There's no meaning and there's no hope of finding meaning.
Some of the arguments against skepticism, I'm going to give these to you real quick. Augustine's reputation is that skepticism is inconsistent. First off, it is rationally inconsistent because the claim that man cannot know is a claim to know something. And you say, well, I say, why are you a skeptic? Because man cannot know. Man cannot know anything. Well, then the question should be, well, how do you know that man cannot know anything if man cannot know anything? Because if man cannot know anything, you wouldn't be able to know that man cannot know, even if man cannot know.
Is that a form of reductio ad absurdum?
Yeah. Reductio ad absurdum of Zeno. Reducing your opponent's argument to its absurd conclusion to prove that it must be false. So it's rationally inconsistent, but it's also practically inconsistent, Augustine argued, because the skeptic cannot consistently live like a skeptic. His family is to spend judgment on everything. Oh, that's, you know, and he says,
I don't know if I need food.
And it's kind of depressing. Let's go get a burger. And, you know, and he doesn't suspend judgment about whether they poison the burger, or does he suspend judgment about the fact that he needs to eat? So nobody lives like a skeptic. And even skepticism itself is also rationally contradictory as well. We already talked about the fact that the verification principle fails its own test because it's not purely definitional and it cannot be verified by any of the five senses. Others have argued that skepticism is against common sense. Thomas Reed, who lived from 1710 to 1796, disagreed with Hume's skepticism. Reed said that the rational proofs for all beliefs are inappropriate. The need for justification must end somewhere, and so basic beliefs are self-evident. They form the base for other beliefs. Our founding fathers held to that view. That you can't look for reasons for every belief. Eventually, you've got to have first principles that are self-evident truths. Okay? John Pollock also argued against skepticism. He says, skepticism never agrees with common sense. If rain falls on my head and the weatherman says that it's raining, why should I doubt that it is raining? Another argument against skepticism, it's in conflict with language. When a skeptic expresses his doubt, he is not skeptical about the words he uses to do so. When you say, are you skeptical? He says, yes. He's not being skeptical. If he's supposed to be skeptical about everything, why isn't he skeptical about his skepticism? Also, skepticism is not a consequence of induction. Deduction attempts to guarantee a certain conclusion. We went over that before. Induction only seeks a probable conclusion. Why should we reject a probable conclusion when the evidence points to it? When it's probably raining outside, why should we reject that just because we can't infallibly prove that it's raining outside? So why should we reject a probable conclusion just because we can't prove it with absolute certainty? Now, there is some value to skepticism because it argues against a dogmatism that does not have good evidence. If you're dogmatic about something but you have no good evidence for it, skepticism can be used to be the corrective there. Skepticism raises two questions. Number one, do you have adequate evidence for your claims to know? Do you have adequate evidence for your claims to know? And number two, Are there contradictions in your system of thought? Are there contradictions in your system of thought? Skepticism raises two questions. Do you have adequate evidence for your claims to know? And are there contradictions in your system of thought? If you claim to know something, the skeptic must be answered. Doesn't mean you have to show that it's infallible. You have to show, hey, look, the reasons are better for me assuming that I know this than they would be for me to suspend judgment on it. And so skepticism is a helpful check in that area. However, I would not classify myself as a skeptic. It can be used in a very handy manner.